Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life is produced by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, a division of the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences. Visit us online at whyradioshow.org.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. On today's episode, we are asking Aubrey de Grey whether aging is a disease that could be cured. While it may sound like an odd question, what would happen if we were to consider aging as an illness instead of a fact of life? What if we regard it not just as a conglomeration of sicknesses like cancer, Alzheimer's disease, or arthritis, but an illness in itself? What if we ask whether we can make our bodies younger again? Is this craziness, or would it be worthwhile? This idea has its precedence. Humans have been socially constructing sickness ever since we developed the concept of normal. Homosexuality was once considered a disease, but now it isn't. Addiction, on the other hand, was regarded as weakness of will, but it is now thought of as an illness with neurological components. In short, what we call healthy is really a set of expectations about how much we weigh, how far we can walk, and which food we can digest. There are two advantages that come from pathologizing aging. The first is that it becomes a potentially solvable problem. We generally regard getting older as a simple, indisputable fact of life. It is the precursor to death, after all, the partner of taxes, the other human certainty. By making aging into a problem, we give ourselves permission to think about it intellectually, to talk to others about it without having to undermine our own interest, and to devote resources to its cure. Philosophy is often attacked for creating problems where there are none, but identifying new controversies is essential to progress. You can't solve a problem if you don't know it's there. The German philosopher Martin Heidegger famously called humanity the being unto death. He argued that what makes us unique is that we are the only animals that know we die, and that this impending death gives our life meaning. But what if instead of seeing death as an unavoidable ending, he saw it as a human challenge, something to overcome? How would his understanding of human beings change if he defined us in terms of our possibilities rather than our limitations? I bring this up because Heidegger was certainly on to something. Death does define a great deal about how we see ourselves. Parents work very hard to teach their kids to be independent so they can manage once their parents are gone. The ideal marriage lasts until one of the couple dies. People scrimp and save to retire so they can spend a few decades free of work responsibility. What would family life look like if your child always expected you to be by their side? Would people still marry if they were expected to be together for 5,000 years instead of 50? What happens to the idea of retirement if people are able-bodied enough to work, well, forever? The latter, the work thing, is a pretty horrifying thought, even for me, and I like my job. Aging is so intertwined in the human experience that if we cured it, we would have to rethink everything else. We'd have to restructure the way we work, play, love, and lament. Maybe then, the refusal to think about aging as an illness to be cured is not a lack of imagination, but a fear of no longer living a life that is comprehensible to us. But if this is the objection, we need to remember that our own lives would be largely incomprehensible to Thomas Jefferson, to William Shakespeare, to Joan of Arc. In fact, most of my own life was incomprehensible to my own grandmother, and she was only 99 when she died, not 990. This doesn't mean she couldn't have learned the things she needed to. It just means she didn't have the time. The other advantage of thinking about aging as an illness is that it shifts getting older from being a literary concern, the purview of poets and novelists, to one of science. The medical industry has long seen itself as managing aging. It is focused on figuring out how to make getting older more pleasant or making dying less traumatic. From morphine to hospice, medical science has advanced palliative care immeasurably, but it considers immortality a non-starter. The same non-starter, I suspect, that people thought going to the moon was, or curing polio, or cloning. Those two required an optimistic view of human capabilities and a faith in human knowledge. What do we have to lose other than death? Today's guest approaches the question of aging from both the philosophical and the scientific perspective. He sees it as both a problem to solve and a perspective to overcome. This makes him a compelling advocate for a project that almost nobody believes will work. It makes the search for the cure for aging possibly the most important underdog story that was ever written. If aging is an illness, it can be cured. And if it can be cured, well, let's find out what's next. And now our guest, Aubrey de Grey, is a biomedical gerontologist and the chief science officer for the SENS Foundation in Mountain View, California. He's the author of Ending Aging, the Rejuvenation Breakthroughs That Could Reverse Human Aging in Our Lifetime. Aubrey, welcome to Why.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
We have pre-recorded the show, so we won't be taking any questions. But if you'd like to send your comments, tweet us at Why Radio Show, post a comment at facebook.com/Why Radio Show, or visit our live chat room at whyradioshow.org. So I had a lot of questions, Aubrey, that I wanted to start with, including some that I ran by you when we contacted each other over email. But as I was driving here, I wanted to ask what amounts to, I think, the first question that comes to mind in people think about immortality. And I want to do it by channeling my best friend's mother, who was born and raised in the Bronx. What are you, crazy? Is this just insanity? Are you taking the greatest fantasy of human beings and taking it seriously in a way that nobody ever actually wanted you to do?
Well, so when people ask me whether I'm crazy, I guess my first response and my first answer is to come back with another question, which is, do you mean, am I crazy to view aging as a potentially solvable problem? Or do you mean, am I crazy to think that it would be a good idea to bring aging under medical control? Now, I think from the elaboration that you gave, that your main thinking is the first of those. Am I crazy to think that aging could, in principle, be brought under medical control? And, you know, it's a reasonable question because, of course, first of all, people have been claiming since pretty much the dawn of civilization that aging already could be brought under medical control by some kind of magic bullet, some kind of fountain of youth. And secondly, because, you know, at the moment, there are not very many experts like myself coming out there and saying that, yes, this is within striking distance. However, the first thing I want to point out is that the number of experts who are saying things that sound suspiciously similar to what I've been saying for the past 15 years is growing. You know, people are beginning to say, yeah, well, you know, there is a lot of progress and we do understand the nature of the problem pretty well now. And yeah, well, you know, I mean, we're going to carry on making progress and eventually, you know, aging is a very, very difficult problem, but it's only finitely difficult. Eventually, we're going to get there. Not very many experts are willing to talk in terms of any kind of time frames yet, and I think that's a big problem. I think that's a failure of responsibility on the part of most of my colleagues, because I feel that unless we do talk about time frames, albeit, of course, definitely very much hedged by emphasis about the speculative nature of those predictions, you know, other people are going to say, well, yes, it will happen 1,000 years from now. It's not a problem for me today, and that will slow down progress. But no, so I think that, you know, it's reasonable to wonder whether I'm crazy, but to actually answer the question, one has to look at the details of not only what I'm saying, but of how what I'm saying is being received by other experts. And then one comes to the answer that, well, you know, probably I'm not crazy.
You know, it's interesting because you are featured in a documentary called The Immortalists. And then about 6 months ago, I think there was an article about this aging research in the New York Times magazine. And a lot of the media coverage of you focuses on, and the people you're working with focus on the psychological motivations. You know, why does the person do this? You know, what is the secret that they are trying to, you know, overcome? How are they eccentric or it seems that these are just ad hominem attacks against the project, that very few people are really taking you at your word as a member of good faith. And let's talk about the science. Let's talk about the philosophy. Do you find that? Do you find that the debates are as much about you and discrediting the you as an agent as opposed to handling the project in itself and dealing with the project on its own terms?
There is a lot of that. There's a lot of looking at motivations, looking at credibility, looking at, you know, as you say, ad hominem aspects of the question. And I think, you know, it's important to point out that these things are happening and that the real meat of the question is often ignored. But actually, at the same time, I have some degree of, well, if not sympathy, at least comprehension of where that's all coming from. The fact is that nobody really wants to get their hopes up on all of this. There is a huge terror of aging that pervades pretty much all of us. Not necessarily even of death, but of the suffering that precedes death from aging. And that is a huge psychological challenge for anybody. It's something that most people can't stomach, and instead they have to find some way to put it out of their minds. And the best way to do that is when they encounter someone like myself who is actually bringing this to the fore, they have on the one hand a great deal of fascination and interest in understanding the plausibility of what I'm saying, but on the other hand they also have a compulsion to maintain some kind of, if you like, emotional distance from the question, from the issue. And the best way to do that is to put themselves in a position of some kind of ambivalence with regard to the credibility of the messenger.
What was the point in your research? What happened when you moved away from just, this is something that you're interested in, to this is something that I can do? Was there a discovery, an innovation, a conceptual shift that allowed you to say, hold on a second, this is real?
Not really. The way it worked for me was actually that I started out from, I don't know, my earliest years, knowing perfectly well that in principle, aging was a medical problem that could be solved, that eventually we would bring aging under just the same degree of medical control that we already have for most infectious diseases. The thing that I didn't know was that most other people didn't think that way. It was such an obvious fact to me that I never did the experiment of raising the topic with other people and thereby discovering, you know, that they thought differently. They thought that aging was some kind of inevitable fact of life. It was only after I met and married a biologist who was a lot older than me and already a senior professor at UC San Diego that I discovered that, no, she was actually not very interested in aging. She thought it wasn't very important. And then I discovered that other biologists thought the same. And then I discovered that people in general thought the same. And I was completely horrified by this. I had gone through until my late 20s just not knowing that fact. So that basically made me feel that I had to switch fields. Now, in terms of your question, really, when I switched fields, it wasn't a case of knowing that I could do something. It was a case of knowing that I needed to try to do something. Having been, for several years by that time, a researcher in a completely different field, in artificial intelligence, I knew, on the one hand, that I was pretty damn good at working on very hard problems, because I had been quite successful in my artificial intelligence research. But I also knew that, by definition, very hard problems are ones that you might or might not succeed in solving. Or someone else might succeed, or whatever. I just knew that by switching fields, by becoming a researcher in this area, I would have some chance of making a contribution, and therefore I would improve the expected time that it would take to actually, for humanity in general, to actually achieve a solution to this problem. I didn't know how important my own contribution was going to be, but I didn't need to know. I just needed to know that I had some significant probability of making some significant contribution.
So I'm interested. I brought up a lot of ideas about death and the way that death figures into human understanding and literature and things like that. But aging and death are not the same thing. So how do you conceptualize aging? When you imagine yourself stopping aging, is it just putting aside diseases, people are no longer going to get cancer, people are no longer going to get Alzheimer's disease, or do you really see the body not getting older?
I really see the body not getting older. I see the body as a machine, a really, really, really complicated machine whose detailed construction and mechanics we are still very, very poorly knowledgeable of, but nevertheless a machine, and therefore an entity that whose function is defined by its structure. Therefore, I understand that if we can engage in comprehensive preventative maintenance every so often, just as we would for a car or an aeroplane or whatever, then we can preserve and maintain the function of the body, both mental and physical, of course, as long as we like. You know, as far as I'm concerned, it's perfectly valid to look at vintage cars, for example. These are cars that are more than 100 years old. They were absolutely never designed to last that long. They were designed to last maybe 10 or 15 years. And yet, by virtue of comprehensive preventative maintenance, here they are working just as well as when they were built. That is the goal.
So is the process to prevent the younger from getting older, or do you think that the discoveries that you make will also help the already older get younger? There's an interesting section of the documentary where you are in an aging clinic and you compared your chronological life with your biological life. And this is something I know that on the internet I've done and other people have done. Can you make people younger? And if so, what do you mean by that?
Absolutely. The idea is to make older people younger again, as well as to stop younger people from getting older in the first place. It's really, again, just the same as it is for a simple man-made machine like a car. You can take a car that's got a lot of rust and you can remove the rust and you can generally put it back into better condition, better function than it was before you started the process. So yes, absolutely, it's a process of rejuvenation that we're talking about. Now, that actually, if you think about it, makes the problem easier than it would be if we were talking about stopping the process from happening. We're not talking about altering the way that the body works in such a manner as to stop it from damaging itself as a side effect of its normal operation. Instead, what we're talking about is letting that damage be created as a side effect of the body's normal operation, but then periodically eliminating damage so that the overall load of damage does not increase long term. And in particular, so that that load is maintained at a level that is tolerable by the body. The body is set up to tolerate a certain amount of damage, and all we need to do is keep the overall amount of damage below that level.
In a little bit after the break, I'll ask you to talk a little bit about the genetics involved and the way that you're actually trying to solve the problem. But before that, I want to talk about a concept that you yourself bring up, and that is the notion of ageism. I want to ask you sort of in advance, what is the ideal age? What age do you think people should remain at biologically or physiologically to have a good life? But if I ask that, then aren't I in some sense devaluing the older folks and suggesting that there's something wrong with being old? You accuse your critics of engaging in ageism by expecting people to die at a certain age. I'd like you to address that. But also, is being old a value and an experience that maybe we shouldn't get rid of?
If we want to answer that question carefully, then we have to distinguish between being chronologically old and being biologically old. I am certainly in no way against people being chronologically old. In fact, I plan to develop technologies which will allow a lot more of us to become chronologically a lot older than people do today. But biologically old, absolutely. I am all for denigrating and deprecating Alzheimer's disease. I am not in favor of it, and I don't want to get it, and I don't want anybody else to get it either. And the same applies for absolutely every other aspect of the diminished performance, both mental and physical, that we see associated with old age. It applies to all of the things that we call diseases, which we really shouldn't call diseases, like most cancers, atherosclerosis, and so on. And it also applies to those aspects of aging that we tend not to give disease-like names to, like decline in function of the immune system, or loss of muscle, or frailty, you know, things that are much more nebulous, but nevertheless just as real when it comes to decline in what we can do.
You know, that's a really interesting distinction that you're making there. Is trying to figure out how to phrase this question. Do we take for granted the process, but that's not right. Why isn't the degeneration of muscular ability? Why isn't the weaknessing considered a disease? Why is it just regarded as something that happens and we're not going to address it? What is it about that amorphous idea that human beings get weaker as they get older that really isn't a focus of serious medical research?
Well, first of all, there is more medical research in those areas than there used to be, so the news is not all bad. But really your question is, why do we carve out certain components of aging and call them diseases and leave other parts as what we think of as, quote, aging itself, unquote?
Thank you. That's a better phrasing.
Yeah. So my take on this is it's purely part of what I was saying earlier, the process of putting aging out of our minds and not letting it destroy our equanimity. Essentially, for me, you know, there is absolutely no biological basis for that kind of distinction. It is, in fact, very counterproductive that we make the distinction, because when we call a part of aging a disease, we make ourselves think that we can cure it in the same way that we might be able to cure an infection. And that results in huge amounts of money being spent totally inappropriately on medical research to achieve this so-called cure, which can't be done because these so-called diseases are actually side effects of being alive, same as the rest of aging is. But why we do it, I believe, yeah, it's a case of, we know that aging is horrible. If we take bits of it and we call them diseases, we allow ourselves to think that those bits are horrible, and that kind of makes it easier to have some residue left that we can kind of make excuses for and pretend it's a blessing in disguise of some kind, thereby allowing ourselves not to think about it too much and to get on with our miserably short lives and make the best of it.
When we come back, I want to pursue this question, obviously, in a variety of different ways, including talking about the biological components and the genetic components. But I will ask you in advance, since we have about another minute or two, what do we have to know? What do we have to get before we go from the conceptual discussion to the scientific discussion? Is there something that we are doing wrong, or a way that we're thinking, other than just the shift into the disease vocabulary, that we need to get past in order to really grasp the potential of the genetic research?
I would say that the one thing that we need to get past is the idea that aging is some kind of mystery. Aging is simply not a mystery. It's not an enigma at all. Not only do we understand a load of the molecular and cellular details of what changes in the body, what eventually causes the and contributes to the decline in health in old age, but also there is a whole bunch of stuff that we just know that we don't need to understand because we have ways to sidestep that ignorance, so to speak. Essentially, you know, the demystification of aging is a huge part of what I have to do, what I have to engage in. I need people to understand that the analogy with simple man-made machines like cars is truly a valid analogy. The fact that the body is alive and cars are not alive does not change the validity of that analogy. The fact that the human body is much more complicated than any man-made machine does not change the validity of that analogy. The fact is, maintenance works. The body is a machine, therefore its function is determined by its structure. Therefore, if we can restore, even approximately, the structure of the human body of an older person to something like what it was as a young adult, then we will restore its function as well.
Well, you've certainly whetted my appetite. I'm very excited to figure out what the next steps are and the science behind it. We'll get to that in a moment. You're listening to Aubrey de Grey and Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We'll be back right after this.
The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life bridges the gap between academic philosophy and the general public. Its mission is to cultivate discussion between philosophy professionals and others who have an interest in the subject, regardless of experience or credentials. Visit us on the web at philosophyandpubliclife.org. The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, because there is no ivory tower.
You're back with Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We're talking with Aubrey de Grey about aging and whether it's a disease that can be cured. I just had my birthday a couple days ago. I turned 48 years old. And my experience of birthdays and age has had sort of two parallel paths, although at least that's how I talk to my students about it. The first was, I remember when I turned 40, really didn't mean that much to me, and I didn't have any deep problem with it. But then about 6 months later, I went to the eye doctor and discovered that I needed bifocals. And that just threw me, and that really put me in a sort of, oh my God, what's happening to me attitude. And then I began to notice, as I progressed in my 40s, that my body began to betray me in ways that it never did before. At the same time, I talked to my students about how difficult and angst-ridden their 20s are, and how they're not going to know where they are, and there's going to be all this drama, but that in general, the 30s are actually wonderful. That the 30s, you have a sense of who you are, you have a sense of what you want. Often you found a community of friends, if not a partner, and there's a confidence and a stability of the 30s that make it a very satisfying decade. I use those two examples because there's two very different experiences of aging there. One is the mechanical breakdown of things, and the other is the experience of wisdom and life. And what we're doing here today, I suspect, is breaking those two things apart. And so, Aubrey, I want to ask you, is there a direct connection between the physicality of aging and the psychological experience of learning and wisdom? Or as a scientist, can you just focus on the machine and leave the experiential elements to other folks?
I believe, as I would call myself a technologist more than a scientist. In other words, someone who wants to manipulate nature more than someone who wants to understand nature. I believe as a technologist, I can indeed leave the psychological side to other people. At the end of the day, you know, so much of our psychology is determined by our physical health anyway, you know, by what we find ourselves able to do, and in particular by what we find ourselves unable to do that we used to be able to do. So I believe that I am already making the job of the psychologists among us a lot easier just by bringing greater physical health, physical and mental functionality to older people.
So let's dive in and ask how that happens. I think most of my listeners, like me, really don't understand the basics of genetics, but you've had a lot of practice in this. So I wonder if you could give us a primer on just what the problems are and how you plan on solving them on the biological and genetic level.
Sure. So as with the preventative maintenance of a simple machine, the first step has to be to characterize what kind of damage is accumulating as, you know, a byproduct, as a side effect of the machine's normal operation, and you know, somehow getting a nice comprehensive catalog of all those types of damage so that one can then develop a corresponding catalog of ways to eliminate the damage so as to restore the structure of the machine to how it was earlier. And the good news, of course, for me was that by the time I started in this field in the mid to late 90s, you know, people had been studying aging for rather a long time, and there was a pretty good catalogue already of what those changes were. And indeed, the good news for me at that time was that it had already been well over a decade, maybe 15 years, since anybody had come up with anything new, any new aspect of molecular or cellular changes that would occur in the body as a consequence of our metabolism, and that appeared to contribute late in life to the decline in health. So that was pretty good news, and I basically took this catalogue. I mean, the catalogue was not like generally viewed as a catalogue, but nevertheless, I was able to make such a list pretty easily just on the basis of what I had learned from the literature and at conferences and so on. And in the year 2000, when I'd been in the field for only about 5 years, I began to realize that none of these various types of damage was really off limits, that all of them had potential ways in which we could actually not simply slow down the rate at which they were created, but actually repair the damage that had already been created in the body. And the reason why this had not occurred to my colleagues studying the biology of aging was largely because a lot of the most promising ways to go about this process were based on technologies that had been developed in other areas of biology, not for the purpose of challenging aging at all. And of course, therefore, these technologies were simply unknown to my colleagues who were studying the biology of aging. So a large part of the reason why over the subsequent maybe 5 or 10 years I had to work quite hard to get my ideas taken seriously was because in order to take them seriously, my colleagues had to, had to learn a lot of stuff that they had not previously viewed as remotely relevant to their own work.
When you're looking at the literature and you're looking at the people who are engaged in it, there's two sets of conversations. One is again on the cellular level, and in a minute I'll ask you about telomeres. I can't remember what how to pronounce it, but the cellular structure. But then there's the other aspect, which is the basic physical fitness. You ride your bike, you eat healthily, you take care of the machine. How much of the preventative stuff happens behaviorally, and how much of it is the advanced medical science and eventually we'll talk about nanobots that are in the that are discoveries waiting to happen? How much of aging is about what we do, and how much of aging is the machine itself?
So I want to emphasize that I'm all for a healthy lifestyle, you know, for not smoking, not getting seriously overweight, you know, generally living the way your mother told you to. I'm all for that. But we must at all times keep a sense of proportion with regard to how much difference that makes. A lot of people will say to themselves, well, you know, a bad lifestyle, bad diet and so on, you're living a lot less long than if you behave right. And that is true. But what people are often thinking is, well, therefore, if I, you know, I take advantage of all the latest knowledge and I eat an unusual diet that's particularly well informed and so on, then I might be able to live a lot longer, like 20 years longer than I would if I only did what my mother told me to. And that simply isn't true. There is absolutely no evidence for that. It seems that the basics, the real basics that we all know already, are almost the best we can do. We can hardly provide any more increment on top of that just by doing something particularly special. You know, no one lives all that much longer. There are certain regions of the world that have particular lifestyles or particular diets, and they live longer than the surrounding areas, but they don't live much longer, you know, a year or two. Now, that's all very well. The reason why I'm all in favor of this is because every day is better than nothing. But what we need to avoid is getting too fixated on that and forgetting that the real damage to aging, so to speak, the damage to damage, will be done by developing medicines that can truly transcend anything that can be achieved by simple lifestyle or indeed today's medicine.
So what kind of things can we do with that medicine? You talked about cleaning up the garbage and the preventative aspects of it. What does biological garbage look like, and how do we get rid of it? Are there limits to how clean they can be? And then I guess the other question is, are there limits to what the machine can do? Can cells only divide so often? Is there just a point where the pieces are just out of the necessary energy or matter to do what they need to do?
Okay, that's garbage is a fine example of a type of damage that I can talk about and explain in pretty non-technical terms. So every cell does a lot of different things to do its job and to keep itself alive and so on. And these processes create byproducts that are not necessary for the function of the cell, but they're still created. Now, if those byproducts are created at a rapid rate, then they will just accumulate and kill the cell pretty quickly, and that would be bad. And you know, we wouldn't live long enough to have offspring, and so natural selection would not look favorably on all of that. Therefore, evolution has created systems that eliminate garbage like that. It either destroys the garbage, or the system may just arrange for the garbage to be excreted from the body. However, the thing is that there are some types of garbage, some kinds of byproduct of metabolism, which are created really, really slowly. And they are the problem. Because if they're created really slowly, then they don't accumulate to a problematic level, a level that gets in the way of the operation of the cell, until late in life. And late in life, evolution doesn't care about us anymore. We may already be dead because we got eaten or we starved to death or whatever. But at any rate, we will have had our offspring. So, we'll have done our bit. So there's not enough selective pressure on evolution to generate the corresponding machinery to destroy or eliminate this type of garbage. And sure enough, when we live long enough in the so-called captivity that we have created for ourselves, we get into a position where those types of garbage do reach a level of abundance that impairs cellular function. And that is the main driver of a number of the most important diseases, so-called, of old age, such as atherosclerosis, of course, the number one killer in the Western world, the driver of heart attacks and strokes. That's caused by the problematic accumulation of oxidized cholesterol. Another example is macular degeneration, which is the number one cause of blindness in the elderly. It's caused by the accumulation in the back of the eye of a particular type of derivative of vitamin A that's responsible for the chemistry of vision. So these things accumulate. And our approach to eliminating those things is to introduce into the human cell new enzymes found in bacteria that are able to break down the stuff that we can't naturally break down. These enzymes are quite easy to find. They do need to be modified in quite tricky ways in order to still work in a human cell, but we have successfully done that in both the cases I've just mentioned, atherosclerosis and macular degeneration. And indeed, the projects have both gone far enough that we've been able to spin them out into startup companies. So this is definitely a viable approach, but as you can probably already tell, it's technically quite challenging. It's not like popping a pill. We have to do things like gene therapy and, cell therapy to actually introduce these enzymes into the body and to have them go where they're needed.
So when you're talking about these enzymes, I have a vision of an analogous process. Tell me if this is right. As I've gotten older, it's become harder for me to digest milk. I've become lactose intolerant. So I take, when I want to, these little pills that provide the enzymes for my stomach that allow my stomach to digest the milk and not have bad things happen. Obviously, this is on the cellular level, but is this the same sort of process that you're talking about, that what we're doing is we're taking foreign enzymes and putting them in there to do a job that our body can't do?
It is very much the same. The main difference between the situation that you have with lactose intolerance and the situation I'm talking about with those two aspects of aging is that you were not lactose intolerant at a younger age. Right. This is an activity that you have lost as a side effect of other things that are going wrong in the body. Whereas the accumulation of oxidized cholesterol in the artery or of this derivative of vitamin A in the back of the eye, these are things that happen throughout life because we simply don't have the genetic machinery at any age to eliminate these things. And eventually their accumulation has knock-on effects, very much as the other changes in the body, in your body, have had that knock-on effect of lactose intolerance. But yes, we have to introduce these things in order to give ourselves functionalities at the enzymatic level that we never had, even as young people.
In a minute, I want to ask you about some other things, but you used a phrase or you made a comment that my philosopher's ears really picked up on. You said that after a certain age, evolution doesn't care about us anymore. And so I guess the first sort of general philosophical question is, does that suggest that the stuff that you are doing is in some way, and I know this is a really problematic concept, but in some way unnatural? But the second is that, do you think that this would have such a profound effect on the human experience that it would alter evolution and human beings either wouldn't change or would change in a fundamentally different way than the evolution seems to be moving now?
Well, first of all, let's look at the question of whether this is unnatural. So on the one hand, I could say, well, obviously it's unnatural, but so is the whole of technology. You know, the wheel is unnatural. You know, all of medicine is unnatural, and there's nothing wrong with that. You know, technology is considered a good thing. Another way of saying the same thing is that technology is natural. In other words, that it is natural for human beings to alter nature in their own interests. So that, you know, if we're doing things to preserve our health beyond what nature allowed us to do, in other words, beyond what evolution bothered to arrange, then so much the better. It's just like the wheel. It's just like antibiotics. I think that's really the straightforward answer.
And do you think that it's a powerful enough change that it would alter evolution itself, or do you think that...
Well, I think that's also kind of the wrong way to look at it. A good way to explain why we mustn't be too parochial and about too simplistic about evolution is to look at our immune systems. So it's perfectly clear, it's widely understood, that the immune systems of typical people today are weaker than they used to be 100 years ago. So we may ask, well, first of all, how did that happen? And second of all, does it matter? And first of all, it happened by evolution. Evolution, over a period of only a few generations, the genetic basis underlying our immune systems underwent a significant shift. And the reason it went through that shift is because historically, in pre-medical times, so to speak, before modern medicine came along, if you had a weak immune system, you tended to die before you had a chance to pass on your genes by reproduction. Whereas now, you can get away with it because we've got hygiene and vaccines and antibiotics and all that kind of stuff. So that's one reason why the selective pressure went away. On top of that, it turns out that women who have weaker immune systems tend to be more fertile because they have a lower risk of an immune rejection of the fetus. So that has further accelerated the process of shifting our immune systems to a weaker state. Now, we may say this is a bad thing. You know, we would prefer to have strong immune systems. But why? I mean, the fact is we have these technologies. The medicine that we've developed over the past century is not magically going to go away at any point. So it's fine, really. And there will be other examples. In fact, I believe that it's pretty much certain that evolution as defined by the change in the genetic composition of the population is going to enormously accelerate really rather soon simply by virtue of the development and implementation of high quality, high volume somatic gene therapy. In other words, alteration of the genetic composition of people who are already alive. Of course, that allows an enormous acceleration because it doesn't involve this terribly time-consuming reproduction step.
Okay, so then the next step is, do the enzymes added to the cells do the whole job, or are there other things we need to do as well?
They certainly don't do the whole job. Normally, how I describe the phenomenon of aging is by breaking it down into seven categories of damage. And the accumulation of molecular waste products within the cell is just one of those seven categories. So, for example, another category is loss of entire cells, cells dying and not being automatically replaced by the division of other cells. Clearly, if that process happens and it continues to happen, then the number of cells in the affected organ is going to continue to decline, and eventually there won't be enough cells for the organ to do its job. So the that's definitely part of aging. We can point to particular components of aging that are fine examples of that. Parkinson's disease is one of them. It's caused by the loss of a particular type of neuron in a particular part of the brain. And, the right way to fix it, of course, is by replacing those cells. Can we do that? Yes, we can. We've got this concept called stem cell therapy, which involves injecting cells into the body that are pre-programmed in the laboratory to divide and transform themselves into replacements for the cells that the body is not replacing on its own. And I could go through the rest of the list, but you get the idea. There's a variety of different types of damage and corresponding ways to repair that damage.
And for those people who are interested, all of this is described in the book Ending Aging with great detail in a very accessible way, although the science stuff I sometimes have to pay a little closer attention to just because of the nature of my mind. I want to ask, if we are stopping aging, does that mean that in theory we are preventing cancer, that lack of aging means also necessarily lack of disease, or are those different systems?
Lack of aging does necessarily mean lack of age-related disease. It doesn't mean lack of tuberculosis or lack of HIV or whatever, but of course you knew that. It certainly means lack of all of the diseases that are associated with old age that younger people don't tend to suffer from, and actually will have knock-on effects on diseases that younger people do suffer from just because of the reusability of certain technological advances. But yes, cancer, for example, absolutely. Most cancers are the result of the accumulation in just one individual cell of a particular constellation of mutations that cause it to misbehave in this or that way and resist the ability of the body to get rid of it. And those mutations happen independently of each other. So it takes time for any cell, even though we have many trillions of cells in the body, it takes time for any one cell to get into that particularly aberrant state. And that makes it part of aging. And the individual mutations that are the drivers of cancer are damaged.
How closely does the community, the anti-aging community, work together? I know that there's other technologies that people are talking about to try to, again, I alluded to these before, try to make cells split indefinitely to lengthen the telomeres. Telomeres. And then there's some discussion of advanced technologies like nanobots that can target particular illnesses, disease genes, damaged cells. How much are you all working together? Are there regular conferences? Now I'm going to sound like an academic. Are there listservs? To what extent is this a group activity, and to what extent is this a lot of people individually working and then coming together periodically to just sort of exchange research?
It's a pretty good group effort. I mean, the community has historically been a little bit too balkanized, people not talking to each other enough. And a large part of the contribution that I've made has been to change that, to bring people together who wouldn't normally be talking to each other, but who are addressing different components, different facets of the same problem, and therefore who would benefit from talking to each other and maybe find ways to put two and two together and make more than four, synergize. Certainly within the community that recognizes the kind of things I say, the fact that aging is a unitary though complex problem, and therefore that the components that it consists of, they interact and they need to be considered as a network, those people certainly understand the vital importance of continued communication. Of course, there is a certain amount of working independently, as in any research area, but yeah, there's a lot of communication.
So let's assume that we can do it, that the research is fruitful, that in the next couple of decades you have the discoveries and the revolution that you actually predict. There is a whole set of objections that people have, not that we can't do it, but rather that we shouldn't do it, that the carbon footprint of people, the overpopulation, the damage that human beings do to one another with war. How do you respond to the people who just say, okay, but just because you can do something doesn't mean you should?
I have a variety of different responses to those kinds of positions. When I'm feeling in a good mood, I will tend to give the detailed, sincere answers to do with why these problems and how these problems can be addressed. For example, problems to do with, well, we put all the people or won't there be too much environmental damage and so on. The right answer to those questions is to point to all of the technologies that we are already developing to minimize and to eliminate those problems. For example, the rise of solar and wind energy, renewable energy, so as to minimize fossil fuel utilization, you know, whether it's desalination, artificial meat, all of these technologies that are coming along really rapidly, not even just in order to solve the environmental issues that humanity creates, but just because these ways are actually ending up being more economical than the old ways of doing things. These are things that are going to increase the carrying capacity of the planet much more rapidly than the elimination of aging would increase the population of the planet. So, you know, it's basically impossible to argue that things would not go that way, that the overpopulation problem we have today would actually get worse in the longer term. It's definitely going to get less bad, whatever we do about aging. But also there are general answers, which may sound a little bit more dismissive, but that I think are just as important. One simple answer is, look, sense of proportion. You know, yes, in principle, we might end up in some kind of outlandish worst-case scenario whereby we were, for example, increasing the population of the planet faster than we were increasing the carrying capacity of the planet. But so the hell what? All that would mean, is that we would be in a position of having to choose between either carrying on the way we are today, you know, with everyone getting really sick when they get older and eventually dying, but before they die having to go through a lot of suffering and a lot of expense and so on, or alternatively, choosing to have fewer kids than we might like to have. You know, that's the choice that we would ultimately be faced with, and you know, it's a pretty easy choice to make. You know, kids are nice to have, but Alzheimer's is also a nice thing not to have. And then, you know, beyond that, we can say, well, okay, even if you dare to be uncertain about that, even if you dare to think that, well, actually, I would prefer to get Alzheimer's than not to have a lot of kids, then we have to ask whether it is today, the population that exists today, who should be making that choice. To me, it's very clear, it's completely unequivocal, that the moral obligation on humanity today is to develop these therapies as quickly as possible so that humanity of the future, let's say 20 years from now, has the option whether to use these therapies, how to use them, which they would not have if we didn't develop the therapies in time. We have no right, it's perfectly clear to me, we have no right to condemn some cohort of the humanity of the future to an unnecessarily early and unnecessarily painful death just because we thought, oh dear, they're not going to be able to fix the overpopulation problem.
You know, it's interesting you say that because there's a component that I didn't even realize I was thinking about, which is that nothing you're saying invites taking away the choice from people, right? Just because you can live forever doesn't mean that someone who doesn't want to doesn't have to, right? No one is going to be forced to take the medicines, presumably.
Correct. I mean, of course, it's a little bit more complicated than that. You know, if these medicines are available and they're made available, you know, for free, you know, irrespective of ability to pay, which I firmly believe they will be, even in really tax-averse countries like the USA. Nevertheless, you know, even if that happens, you know, we've got to ask, you know, what will society think of people who choose to get old and sick and frail and eventually dead anyway. And I think actually, to be honest, we're going to call those people suicidal, the way that we call people today who want to die sometime soon when they don't have to, when they're still, when they have the option to continue being physically and mentally healthy. So we're probably going to try and change those people's minds in very much the same way that we try to change the minds of suicidal people today. But at the end of the day, it's still a choice.
You said the thing that actually my wife wanted to bring up, which is, wouldn't this end up being just for the rich? And you said just now that you think it would be given to everybody free, regardless of their ability to pay. And so I guess the sort of towards the end of this conversation, I want to ask, is this really just a question of optimism versus pessimism. You seem to have a very optimistic attitude about human beings, that they will give this stuff for free, that this can happen, that we will solve the problems. And I think that our age right now is a very pessimistic age. We had Steven Pinker on the show quite a few years ago when his book Better Angels of Our Nature came out. And his argument is that we are living in a less violent period than any time ever before, and we're less likely to die by violence in any time ever before. And that actually the liberal community was really upset with this and found it objectionable. And there was a fundamental pessimism that people wanted to think that the world was worse off than it is. We live in a fairly pessimistic age. Is part of the disconnect and part of the reason why not everyone is responding as positively to your research as you would like, and I think as I would like at this point, that you're just an optimist in a way that people aren't used to?
Well, yes and no. I mean, Pinker was, of course, completely correct. The data do not lie. It's absolutely clear that we live in a far less violent world, and in general a world with far less suffering than we did even 50 years ago or 100 years ago or more. No question. But yes, I mean, of course, the danger is that if I allow myself to be called an optimist, then people will think that I'm an over-optimist.
Right.
But I don't think that's true. I think that the pessimists are the unreasonable people who are not looking at the data. When I say I'm sure that these therapies will be available to everybody, irrespective of ability to pay, even in the USA, I'm basing that on the simple economic logic, the fact that the expense, the money that we spend today on people who are not getting these therapies because they don't yet exist, is astronomical, and therefore that these therapies, even if they end up being quite expensive at first, will unquestionably pay for themselves many times over very quickly. In other words, from the point of view of the economy of the country, that any country that did not make these things available free of charge, basically, to anybody who was old enough to need them, would go bankrupt really quickly by virtue of failing to compete with countries that were doing so. It's just straightforward mercenary economic logic. Now, I don't pretend to be an economist. This is very simplistic economic logic. But I have talked to plenty of economists and challenged them and said this thing. And nobody has come back and said, no, Audrey, you are wrong. Actually, for this reason and that reason, this logic will not work and these therapies will not be made available to everybody. Nobody's done that. So until somebody does do that, I think I'm entitled to point out that nobody's done that. And that, the knee-jerk presumption that these therapies are going to increase our inequality is complete nonsense.
You know, a theme has developed in this show over the years, and it's emphasized by what you're saying now and the connection to our show last month with Rutger Bregman, who was arguing for everyone getting a universal basic income. And his argument was that giving everyone or the people who need it this money is cheaper than the welfare system and cheaper than poverty. And you're saying the same thing. And it's just astonishing that over and over again we get this argument that it is cheaper to help people than it is to ignore people.
This is right. I mean, the point is we don't actually ignore people.
Right.
What it is it's cheaper to help people soon, early, than to help people late.
Right.
Prevention is better than cure. I mean, it's not exactly a new idea.
So would it then, and I guess this will probably be the last question, would it be more accurate for me to have asked the question not can we cure aging, but rather can we prevent aging? Is that a more accurate description of what your long-term goal is?
Well, of course, words are always dangerous. You know, the word immortality is a word that's associated with my work all the time, and it's really problematic. Of course, you've not made that mistake. Thank you very much.
Anytime.
but it happens all the time, and it really annoys me because, you know, it's got an established meaning. And even the word disease and the word cure are difficult words for me because, you know, when you use those words, it kind of goes against what I'm emphasizing, that the so-called diseases of old age are actually parts of aging. They're not like infections. They can't be cured in the same way that an infection can. So I try to avoid those as well. I really, you know, to be honest, the my preference would be to make all of my statements without using the word aging at all, so as not to introduce all of these ambiguities. But at the end of the day, it's all about treating aging as a medical problem, something that can be addressed by pretty obvious measures that are, well, obvious in the sense of how we can describe them. Obviously, they haven't implemented them all yet. You can understand what I'm saying. The terminology gets in the way a lot.
Absolutely. And the terminology also hides or privileges certain philosophical issues that I actually think you've done an outstanding job of bringing out to us in a way that we can all understand. And I think that a way that makes us hopeful. I've been looking at your stuff and I am excited about the prospect, and I really hope you are right. So, Aubrey de Grey, thank you so much for joining us on Why.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to Aubrey de Grey and Jack Russell Weinstein on Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, and we'll be back with a few thoughts right after this.
Visit IPPL's blog, PQED, Philosophical Questions Every Day, for more philosophical discussions of everyday life. Comment on the entries and share your points of view with an ever-growing community of professional and amateur philosophers. You can access the blog and view more information on our schedule, our broadcasts, and the Why Radio Store at www.philosophyandpubliclife.org.
You're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We were talking with Aubrey de Grey about aging and asking whether we should regard it as a disease that can be cured. And I think there are a lot of lessons from this discussion, including stuff that I'm going to have to do a lot more research on, the scientific stuff that interests me that I'm really not prepared to grasp fully. But what strikes me as the most important message is something that we've really encountered before, which is that it's all how you start the conversation. Can we cure aging is a very different question than what do we do about aging? Regarding aging as a disease, although Aubrey said he doesn't like that as much, is very different than regarding aging as just what the body does. It's all how you start. And then once you start in a way that problematizes, everything else seems to come naturally. We know cancer is a disease. We want to cure it. We know HIV is an infection. We want to cure it. We knew that Ebola or anything else was destroying people. And because we thought of it in this way, we developed resources to fix the problem. We don't think of aging as a problem. We think of it as a nuisance. We think of it as an economic problem. We think of it as an emotional difficulty. But we think about aging itself as a nuisance. And I think the major conceptual shift, which we actually started with, it was the thing we began with, is moving the idea of aging from the thing that we have to learn to put up with and maybe make easier to the category of things we can solve. I'm not qualified to know whether that can happen. Aubrey de Grey sounds like he is, and he's working with some other very smart people, and I'm glad they're doing it. We have to take the experts' word on this in that even if it can't be done, it's worth trying. And that's the same message that philosophy gives. Even if it can't be answered, it's worth trying. And I think ultimately, that may be one of the lessons of aging that won't be lost if we continue moving forward in an indefinite way. Trying is necessary. Thinking about problems to solve is natural. And structuring our inquiry in such a way that we can be proactive rather than reactive or even apathetic changes the whole game. And certainly, I think we would all be happy if the aging game was one of those things that was changed. You've been listening to Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. Thank you for listening. As always, it's an honor to be with you.
Why is funded by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, Prairie Public Broadcasting, and the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences and Division of Research and Economic Development. Skip Wood is our studio engineer. The music is written and performed by Mark Weinstein and can be found on his album Lua y Sol. For more of his music, visit jazzfluteweinstein.com or myspace.com/MarkWeinstein. Philosophy is everywhere you make it, and we hope we've inspired you with our discussion today. Remember, as we say at the Institute, there is no ivory tower.